Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information, security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and it was funny, I saw a tweet earlier this week which said, it's only cybersecurity if it comes from Washington, D.C. Otherwise, it's just information security. So that's why this is an information security podcast, I guess, and not a cybersecurity podcast. Anyway, on this week's show, we're going to recap all the week's security news. We got Zoomgate, we've got these huge proposed GDPR fines, all of that good stuff. And then we're going to move on straight into this week's sponsor interview. And this week's show is brought to you by our wonderful friends at Signal Sciences. I guess you would call them a next generation WAF company. Ew. But yeah, Signal Sciences co-founder and CTO Zane Lackey will be along in this week's sponsor interview to plug their new cloud WAF and also to have a bit of a chat about a shift Zane is seeing at non-security conferences like networking events, developer conferences, that sort of thing. That theme is more security content and quite good and relevant security content. That is coming up later, but first up, it is news time, and Adam, Zoomgate has given us all the lols we need, all the lols we deserve this week.
Yeah, we've seen a few headlines talking about some bugs in Zoom's video conferencing software. It's a component, they provide video conferencing software, but it's also used as a component in some other kind of branded bits of video conferencing software. And yeah, we've seen a bug that lets you turn on the microphone, like invite people to join a video call without any other confirmation when they visit a website under your control, which, you know, not exactly a complicated thing to do.
Auto join with video on, right? And the guy found this, did a proof of concept website, and people started joining it and it dumped them all into the same room. He actually wrote to me and he's like, hey man, you know, jump in. Are you going to cover this on your podcast sort of thing? So yeah, I think at that time there were like 100 people in there all talking about the bug.
Yeah, it's truly the futuristic way of you know, discussing your bug is to use the bug to form your own chat group. Good plan.
Now, look, there's a few interesting things here. Now, the bug itself, right, like it is getting so much attention, even though it's not really that critical, right? Because you're going to see Zoom fire up, you know, you're going to know you're in a Zoom meeting that you didn't intend to join. But there were some details in the original write-up of this that show us all just what a piece of crap Zoom actually is. Tell us about the listener they put on localhost, Adam.
So the way this works is to do browser integration with their native code that does all the video stuff, you could either register a browser handle like you would do on a sensible platform, but Safari doesn't really like that. And so what they did was they built a separate web server that runs on localhost on your local machine. And then the browser makes requests using, you know, JavaScript XHR to the localhost web server to then, you know, kind of fire up the video conferencing client, configure it, set it on its way, that kind of thing. Of course, that means that anybody can make JavaScript requests from the web page running in your browser to localhost and talk to that thing. And of course, now you've got a whole bunch of attack surface that probably you didn't really think about. And yeah, there's bugs to be found there.
Yeah. Now, where this gets interesting is even if you uninstall Zoom, it comes back if you happen to hit a link invite or whatever, because this web server will automatically reinstall it for you.
Yeah, which is also not ideal, and of course makes you wonder, how does that reinstallation mechanism work?
Funny you should mention that. Now, this is the thing. The guy who did this research, I think his name is Jonathan, and I'm going to mangle this pronunciation. I think it's Lightshu. Now, I got a bit of inside baseball on all things Zoom bugs, right? And I'm going to be careful about what I say here. But he got like 90% of the way there, but didn't get to the really good bit. And that's why we're kind of leading this week's show with it. Some months ago, a large Silicon Valley brand actually funded a bug bounty on Zoom. And one of the bugs that was found as part of that bug bounty and reported to Zoom months ago was an RCE. And yeah, let's just say that this guy got close to finding the RCE, but didn't actually find it. It's a bug that I could literally explain in about 10 to 15 seconds on this podcast and mayhem would ensue. I've explained it to you, right? Would you agree with that assessment?
You did. That is a reasonable assessment, yes.
I mean, it's just absolutely terrible stuff. Now, of course, I was thinking, well, you know, they obviously would have patched it, right? So I go
obviously,
and look at...
right?
Yeah. So I go and look at Zoom's release notes. every single patch that they've released this year has been that, well, you know, first of all, there's no mention of the bug, the RCE. Of course, second of all, every single patch is a manual download one. The only prompted like update they've done is the one on July 9 to deal with this. Now, on the positive side, when Jonathan first published his blog post, the only way to remove that listener, oh, and that's the best thing too, it persists after, you know, after you uninstall. That's what it's there for, right? So that it can auto-install for you, should you have made the terrible mistake of removing Zoom from your computer. so you could manually remove it. Now they are actually discontinuing the use of that, like, web server on localhost. But the thing is, like, anyone who hasn't actually downloaded, like, the patch from yesterday, they are straight up vulnerable. And this is Mac only, but they're straight up vulnerable to that RCE.
Yeah, so that, you know, hundreds of people hanging out in his website chat room thingy. Yeah, maybe it's maybe the safest place to be. Maybe there's a reason Pat wasn't hanging out there.
Yeah, so there's that. So I think, look, and you know, we've seen similar horror show bugs pop up in things like WebEx. I think BlueJeans also has a similar, like, localhost web server. Running this video conferencing stuff, like, really, it's you know, it's dangerous stuff, right?
Yeah, it is. And also, I mean, there are mechanisms to try and control them. I mean, the browser, the sandbox is there to protect you, you know, protect the native environment on your machine, you know, from the rest of the horrible internet. And anytime you introduce a piece of software that's going to circumvent that control, and this is one of the ways you can do it, you know, you open up, you know, your product and all of your users to just a whole world of pain that really you would hope people want to think through, but they don't, right? Because it's not, security is not really a, you know, a thing that you worry about when you're marketing a video conferencing solution.
I wonder too if this RCE would persist if someone, say, installed Zoom a couple of months ago, like a year ago, then uninstalled it and forgot about it. That listener's still there. And I think the only way to get rid of that is going to be to reinstall it and then reinstall the latest version. So this could be actually a bit of a permabug in some edge cases, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think people who are not across the reporting and who don't, you know, see the suggestions that you do need to remove this by hand or you need to upgrade it, then yeah, they're going to be stuck in a vulnerable state for the rest of time. And you would hope that Zoom, the company, would triage that, understand that, you know, the customers with whom they had a previous relationship, maybe they've still got some contact information, maybe they should be a little bit more open about what the bugs are and the steps that people are going to need to take. Because I wouldn't want to be, you know, on the wrong end of a class action suit, you know, if they did end up getting, you know, if someone worms it or sticks it on a bunch of ad sites and, you know, really starts to get you know, a whole lot of people, a whole lot of owners. You know, Mac users probably are more litigious than other platform users, I'm going to go ahead and guess.
Yeah, so I just say to people who are playing around with this, and, you know, there is a lot of renewed interest, the reason I mentioned this is someone else is going to find this, right? Just keep looking. It's there.
Now.
It is there. Now, look, you know, moving on to sort of more high-impact news, British Airways is apparently facing a, you know, $229 million US dollar fine. That's £183.39 million. They're facing a fine under the GDPR for being mage carted, which is amazing. Now, this is just a proposed fine at this stage. I do believe there's going to be a series of appeals, but holy dooly, that's a lot of cash.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think, you know, the European Union in general, you know, really want to do send a message that GDPR is a thing you do not want to trifle with and that people do need to take, you know, their obligations to protect data, whether it's, you know, on-prem, whether it's third-party, whether it's integrated with, you know, JavaScript that comes from third parties. In the end, the obligation is still yours as the custodian of that data. And I think, yeah, this is really, you know, just to send a warning shot you know, across everybody else who's looking at GDPR and going, well, maybe we don't really, you know, maybe we can get away with, you know, the kind of practices we've been doing in the past and it'll be all right. And yeah.
But look, I got to say, a major airline like British Airways getting mage carded, like, to me, that is one that I look at and I say, guys, that's not good enough, right?
No, it's not. But I mean, then again, loads of people get loads of shopping carts owned, right? And
we got a story about that in a moment. But surely, like, if you're a company of that scale, you're doing some sort of file integrity checking on your web server, for God's sakes. Come on.
Well, I mean, if you're a company of that scale, probably you have a whole bunch of ancient Solaris boxes that no one's patched in, you know, 15 years that's actually running everything important. So, I mean, you know, there's sort of a mid-tier of organizations that are new enough to have security practice. And I think airlines in general are probably older than that.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know if you can hold them up as an example of doing it right.
Now, some research came out of Sanguine Security showing that, you know, there's been 962 confirmed MageCart breaches just recently. Like, this is an ongoing thing.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, I mean, the kind of Magecart style, like not just that particular group, but that's the style of, you know, getting yourself into the JavaScript that's a handle on processing pages by whatever means necessary. You know, we've seen that really kind of pick up after people have realized quite how effective it is. This particular write-up is about a fairly automated campaign, exploiting some web app bugs in whatever CMS or shopping cart to go and drop, some fairly generic Magecart style tooling there. We are seeing quite a bit of work done with this type of code to, you know, support a whole bunch of payment gateways. I mean, I think there was some reporting that there was a variant of this style of malware that supported something like 57 different payment gateways. Like, that's quite a lot of work and integration testing and stuff when you don't necessarily have, you know, test accounts and test things. And yeah, so good work, I guess.
Innovation. But look, it's not just BA. Marriott is also facing a fine, this one for 100 million squid, or about $123 million US. And this is over their breach where, you know, everybody's passport numbers and, you know, what was it? It was 383 million guest records.
Yeah, that was also not great.
Also not great. And they are facing, a big fine as well. So it feels like, you know, there have been GDPR sanctions levied against companies for the privacy stuff, but it feels like regulators are sending some clear signals that these types of breaches aren't, you know, it's not good enough.
Yes, and I think the message this sends is that, you know, what matters is the outcomes, and just kind of doing the dance PCI style, like where you've got a whole bunch of controls and everybody knows that you're scoping it down so that they're not really helpful, you know, just isn't good enough. And some kind of outcomes-based thing where you're going to get fined because you got owned, not because you didn't tick all of the boxes just right, when we all know the boxes are a lie. So yeah, I think, you know, this is kind of sending a message that we have to be a bit more realistic as a, you know, as an industry as a whole.
Indeed. Now, some reporting on Huawei that I really, I'm not sure I know how I feel about this one, but there's been a study done that based on some leaked CVs, some leaked resumes that showed, you know, kind of a bit of a revolving door between Huawei and Chinese intelligence services. But, you know, you kind of expect, I mean, we work in InfoSec, right, where we see that, you know, Bob is at NSA, now Bob is working for this company, now Bob is back in the IC or some sort of contractor. You sort of see that in the security industry, but I guess this study is trying to imply that the links in the Huawei case are a little bit stronger than what we necessarily see in countries like Australia or America.
Yeah, this report's based on, you know, a whole bunch of CV data from various sources. Some of it does seem to be leaked from recruitment sites and things. And I guess the core assertion is that there are people who not just went from, you know, the Chinese military into Huawei or vice versa, but were actually like in their CV saying that they were reporting to both at the same time, that they were concurrently employed by the Chinese government and by Huawei. And there's a little bit of inference of, you know, well, you know, they're working on technologies which kind of sound sort of backdoor-y. But that, I don't know, that bit seemed a bit of a stretch to me. But, you know, on the other hand, also people lie in their CVs quite a lot. So, you know, it's hard to know whether to, you know, how much to take away from this particular study.
Yeah, I'm glad you had that reaction too, because I just read it and I'm like, oh, it sounds, you know, it's a great headline, but I don't know how much this really tells us. You know, it's hard to get a frame of reference there. Some great reporting from Yahoo News, actually, about the true origins of the Seth Rich conspiracy theory. And surprise, surprise, it's been tracked back to a Russian intelligence service.
Yeah, so this story about a DNC staffer that got robbed and murdered in Washington or in Baltimore, I think it was. That got spun into this big conspiracy theory that it was like Hillary Clinton's hitman because he was the guy responsible for leaking the stuff to the DNC emails, like Hillary's emails and stuff, which, you know, always sounded super dubious to start with. But yeah, the reporting here that Yahoo's been doing, they've actually tracked down, I guess, some correspondence between the Russian, aspects of the Russian intelligence agencies that were involved in coordinating this. It just kind of comes out that really this was straight up, you know, propaganda by the Russians fed to the kind of right-wing American conspiracy theorists, all the ones who, you know, purportedly are against Russians and communists, and yet they're the ones, you know, propagating their propaganda very effectively. So, it's just,
well, the Russians aren't communists anymore.
Well, I mean, you know what I mean, right?
I know what you mean. And it is wild to see how this came from like one bogus like intelligence report that was just planted and then sort of puffed up by WikiLeaks offering rewards for information on his murder, saying our sources take risk, you know, deliberately implying that he was a source, despite the fact that they say they never discuss who their sources are. And then, you know, from there onwards to InfoWars and then eventually Fox News. So it's just an interesting little look at the, you know, the origins of that whole thing. The US Coast Guard, Adam, I've got to do it. How often am I going to get to use that, right? Like, how often?
I don't know, rubbing my temples conveys across a podcast, but it's totally what I'm doing.
The US Coast Guard has issued a warning about malware designed to disrupt ships' computer systems. Now, I did read some reporting over the last month or so that, you know, people working for the Iranian government were actually targeting ships. I'm guessing this is to do with Iran stuff.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, the sort of at a basic technical level, a boat is just a set of industrial control systems that happens to float. And we all understand that, you know, probably the same sorts of techniques are going to work that work everywhere else that there's industrial control systems. But it does seem like there are some specific examples of groups now actually going and looking out to compromise boat-related systems, which, yeah, makes sense that the Iranians would be interested in that. I mean, obviously, a lot of the conflict that does involve shipping and logistics, plus, of course, any opportunity to, you know, to leverage the cybers seems to be in vogue for this particular conflict. So, I mean, I don't know what practical advice we're going to offer to you know, to listeners that happen to be in charge of security for large shipping fleets, because that stuff doesn't change particularly quickly, which is obviously true of other control systems applications as well. But you know, what are you going to do, like install McAfee on your boat? I don't know.
Well, I mean, if you read between the lines here, it seems pretty clear that, you know, what I've inferred from this is that there's no separation between the control networks and the, you know, the regular sort of junk internet networks that are on these ships. And that is a hell of a vulnerability, right? It is a hell of a vulnerability. I mean, a sort of systemic vulnerability that an adversary like Iran is going to use given the opportunity, right?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You can fish one guy's, you know, Hotmail or whatever who happens to be a crewman on a boat, and you can turn that into control of, you know, the navigation or the engine control systems or the cargo manifests or whatever other stuff you're after. Then, yeah, I mean, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, interesting stuff. But, you know, like if you're doing a pen test on a boat and you pop a shell, you know what you say?
What do you say? I'm on a boat.
That's what you say, man. It had to be done. It had to be done. Now, U.S. Cyber Command, staying with, you know, U.S. government warnings, U.S. Cyber Command has issued an alert about people using this Outlook DDE thing, this DDE bug, which, you know, feature bug sort of thing. But this is interesting. It's still actively being used. And this specifically relates to APT-33, which is an Iranian crew.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've seen a lot of techniques for turning single-factor access to a mailbox into code exec on the internal network. So, you know, coming in through Outlook Web Access and the associated endpoints. The SensePost guys have done a lot of work on their Ruler tool for doing this kind of thing. And, yeah, we have seen this technique and this tooling in particular, you know, picked up by a bunch of groups because it's such a, you know, useful technique for turning 1FA into remote code exec. The particular one they're exploiting here is a new trick the SensePost guys came up with for configuring Outlook and then turning that into code exec via the external endpoint. So yeah, big reminder, whether or not you're a target for the Iranians, that, you know, 1FA Outlook web access on the internet really does expose a whole bunch more than your email if you're not keeping up to date with the patches and, you know, 2FA in general.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man, PGP lols this week.
Yeah, some bad times in the PGP community at the moment. Somebody's been going around essentially causing a denial of service on the PGP ecosystem as a whole by like over-signing a bunch of keys that are stored in the various public key servers. So if you take a key that's relatively popular, is in a bunch of signature chains, and then sign it a whole bunch, you can end up with, you know, kind of algorithmic complexity denial of service against software that parses those keys. So, you know, GNUPG, for example, on Linux, parsing PGP key trust chains. And yeah, because the public key stores are designed to be kind of write-only, this is a real problem. And a couple of the PGP guys whose keys have actually been targeted by this attack have written some, you know, fairly salty blog posts, and understandably salty because it's an attack on, you know, them personally as well as the ecosystem that they work on, basically saying that the existing key server system as designed and used for the last 15 years is essentially dead. And this kind of attack can't be stopped. And we're just going to have to move to a different way of distributing and signing PGP keys as a whole, which is, you know, a thing they knew about, but it's just kind of a sad thing that's happened, or a sad thing that is happening.
Well, I think I was just sitting here trying to think why I find this funny. And I think I might have realized that it's because, you know, PGP types have just always been so smug. So when something like this happens, you're just like,
there is a certain degree of that, I guess. Yeah. Like, I mean, they are a type, I guess, the old school cypherpunks. Obviously, you know, I have a PGP key and I've used PGP for many years and I would probably count myself among them. So, but yeah, no, I do understand the sentiment that you're expressing. There's a certain degree of that, you know, classic Unix, you know, here's a nickel, kid, get yourself a new computer kind of thing with PGP nerds.
Yeah. There is.
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean. Moving on.
But I mean, there are some possibilities for pretty real impact from this, you know, for automated software, like install verification and stuff. So we might see this turn into a thing that is, you know, actually causes problems, you know, outside the, you know, Fedora neckbeard community.
I was wondering that too, like how many actual software updaters could be impacted by this. But I mean, most people are kind of not relying on these key stores for that stuff, are they?
Well, we do see the key stores used to distribute key materials, so it might not happen immediately, but maybe if you roll major version release of your Linux distribution, for example, that you might end up pulling keys from the key servers, which then breaks your machine mid-install, and that's the end of that. And if that happened on a large scale, or a cloud platform or something like that, I mean, you could see it like break a new image deployment on Amazon, for example, right? And that would be bad.
That would be bad. You're right. It is bad. I shouldn't laugh. It just brings out my inner Nelson, you know? That's all it is. Now, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. This is a really interesting turn of affairs. They are mining driver's license photos for facial recognition in the United States. Now, look, governments using facial recognition technology, you know, might result in some really positive things. You might use it to identify people who are wanted for serious crimes, that sort of thing. That's great. But at the moment, it's a free-for-all. There doesn't seem to be any sort of regulation, any sort of restriction saying that the technology will only be used to do face matches in the case of investigations into serious crimes, that sort of thing. And I think, you know, stories like this highlight to me the need for us to start putting some restrictions on how governments can use this tech.
Yeah, I mean, the technical capability to do this kind of mass facial recognition and to do it from databases that already exist, that predate the existence of that technology, you know, is a thing that has just changed in the last, you know, year or two as the tech has just kind of started to get viable. And the question is kind of how viable, whether it's good enough for the sort of things they want to do with it. But yeah, just letting them go and use it wholesale, you know, without us really having discussions as societies, you know, as to what's acceptable, yeah, isn't great at all. And this, you know, ICE, of course, are a particular problem just because they are so much in the headlines lately for being kind of jerks.
Yeah.
London,
and, you know, look, staying with facial recognition, London police, there's a report into the use of London police's use of facial recognition. And I don't know that this headline really captures the success of the tech as used there, but it, you know, the headline says that it fails 80% of the time and must stop now. But you read the story, you realize the truth here is a little bit more nuanced.
Yeah, this is based on a study about a deployment of facial recognition tech by the UK police in and around some particular area.
It was a shopping centre, I think.
Around a shopping centre, yeah. And I mean, in this particular case, they fed it a bunch of wanted people and then they used the cameras to spot people that the police should then go and talk to figure out if they were the people who they thought they were. And in this particular case, yeah, it was something like 80% of the matches were not effective. But I mean, this is in the end a pretty small sample set. And that's obviously, you know, drawing a conclusion about the effectiveness of the tech at a large scale from, you know, we're talking like 40 people's worth of matches, you know, is perhaps not super useful, but it really does, you know, back up that assertion that this is a set of tech that we need to kind of understand the parameters of before we let everybody just go and use it everywhere.
Yeah, so they stopped 26 of the 42. Some of them just, you know, disappeared in the crowd or whatever. And in 14 of those cases, the matches were found to be incorrect. But I'm guessing that means in 12 of those cases, that means the match wasn't incorrect. And again, look, if you're searching for people who are wanted for serious crimes, do you think that's worth the trade-off there? Just someone saying, excuse me, sir, can I see your license? Because the camera thinks that you're this guy who's wanted for attempted murder.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, right? I mean, these are trade-offs that we kind of have to figure out, you know, what we want in terms of our society. Like, do we want a papers, please kind of thing? Do we want a free-for-all libertarian paradise? Do we want something in between that's more pragmatic? You know, I don't know.
But this is why, for me, it all comes back to restricting this by crime type. Like, if you're talking about seriously dangerous people, right, who have skipped bail or whatever, find them. That's fine. But once you start using it to, you know, to find people for sort of trivial, you know, civil offences or whatever, that's where it gets problematic for me. I think for serious crime, it's kind of good.
Yeah, I mean, this is the conversation that we need to kind of figure out where those lines are and when how people feel about, you know, the creepy Orwellian future we're doomed to live in.
Now, some time ago, we spoke about a breach at this company, Perceptix, which does license plate scanning at the US border and apparently pictures of travelers' faces. Now, I don't think when we spoke about it, we were talking about how maybe it included the face pictures of people coming in. I think that was only at the vehicle crossings, land borders. We might have said airports, but look, doesn't matter, right? Like, same thing. It's traveler information, and it looks like Perceptix now has been suspended from doing government business. So bad news for them. You know, we're seeing, you know, the theme this week is consequences coming from breaches.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, right? I mean, real-world impact has to have real-world consequences. And, yeah, we're seeing a bunch of things come home to roost here. And, you know, if you've had a bunch of guidelines about how you were supposed to handle this data as a government contractor and you didn't meet up with them, then, yeah, maybe you deserve to be blacklisted from doing business.
I don't want to dwell on this one too much, but there's been another insecure Elasticsearch instance just sort of popped up on the internet containing 90 million records from some Chinese public security department. I mean, half the time these don't even make it into the news because they happen so often, but I figure we should throw one in this month, you know, just so it's there.
I think especially because I did make a wisecrack about some data ending up in a public Elasticsearch last week, and here it is.
So, and there it is. There it is. Oh, now this one's pretty funny, actually. I got to stop laughing at these things. I really do.
At this one when I read it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the UK's largest police forensics lab actually paid to unlock some ransomware-infected computers.
Oh, dear.
Hang on. Had to bust out the sad trombone for that.
We did. Yeah, this is actually a company based in Brussels that manages labs all around the place, doing a bunch of things, not just police forensics work. But yeah, they got themselves ransomware, and I guess their backups weren't very good, and they had to go pay out. And that's just not good enough. If you're doing police forensics or you're handing people's blood tests or whatever other stuff they're doing, like, that's just not good enough. So yeah, no biscuit, big sad trombone.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out too that a lot of this modern ransomware, a lot of it is manually installed these days, and they go after the backups. Unless you've got offline backups, like, chances are, if you're just backing up to some sort of attached storage, like, you're cooked.
Yeah, offline backups, they're worth quite a lot when someone comes gunning for you, and something that lasts over time. And yeah, and of course, there's also no guarantee when you pay that these people have actually exited your network. So you still got to do the response anyway. You're not really saving any money.
Well, but you're saving the data, right? And I'm guessing forensics data is, you know, kind of important stuff. So there you go. Maybe. Wonder if there'll be any, you know, people disputing evidence because it could have been tampered with by attackers. Good luck. Good luck to desperate defendants who are going to try that on. Mozilla. Now, look, you know, talk about dressing up a story for the mainstream. Reuters here has a report that essentially, to me, what it looks like this report says is that Mozilla is going to deny the UAE company Dark Matter the ability to be a CA, but it has been written up as Mozilla blocking UAE's bid to become an internet security guardian, which is one way to say CA. But I mean, which gist is right, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, this is about the, I think we covered it a while ago, that they had applied, Dark Matter had applied for a root CA authority to be shoved into Mozilla's trust store, and there was obviously a bunch of outcry at the time. Since then, we've seen the stories about Dark Matter and the relationship between them and the kind of Project Raven hacking and various other UAE government apparatus, and that really put the willies up the Mozilla CA team, and there they've made the choice now that they're not going to allow Dark Matter's root CA into the Mozilla antitrust store. Of course, the assumption is that the other browser manufacturers and OS vendors will follow suit, because Mozilla does tend to kind of lead the pack here.
They do. They really do.
It is a little interesting because there isn't a whole bunch of hard evidence, I suppose, that they've abused it or, you know, that...
Well, and that's the ironic thing, right? Like, that's not how sort of modern APT stuff works. Like, you're not using your position in the root store to like come up with dodgy certs. You know, I'd be very surprised if anyone were going to conduct a campaign like that, because once you've got proof that that's what's been going on, it is like literal cryptographically signed proof.
And of course, I mean, that's where we've been heading with the certificate transparency and a bunch of the other work around the CIA ecosystem to try and make it fit for purpose.
I still don't think dark matter should get a cert, though. Like,
Totally agree, obviously, because nothing good can come of it.
No.
Just go get a cert from Let's Encrypt, everyone.
That's you don't right.
get one from dark matter.
Or just host your stuff on Azure and use Microsoft certificates.
Yeah, exactly, right.
A big kerfuffle in the UK, and this is a weird one.
And this is the alternate, you know, kind of mirror universe headline.
Yeah, exactly, which is, I'll just read the headline. It's from Catalin Kimpanu at ZDNet. UK ISP group names Mozilla Internet villain for supporting DNS over HTTPS. And it's like, that's when you read the headline and you're like, okay, you know, your head goes to the side and you go, okay, I'm going to click on that one. That's
good work on the clickbait.
Tell us about this story.
Yeah, this is Mozilla's been talking about adding support for DNS over HTTPS, where you do your DNS queries over a TLS connection to some known, you know, name server that supports that protocol, instead of via the traditional port 53 TCP or UDP mechanism, which has a bunch of really positive things for allowing you to have a bit more trust in the way that your DNS gets kind of bootstrapped. But the problem here is that there's been a bunch of regulation in the UK lately trying to make service providers implement filtering for adult content. And a lot of that relies on hijacking the DNS answers to redirect people away from pornography sites, unless they've, you know, completed whatever process they have to go through. So
it's a pretty lame way to do filtering, though, right? I'm really surprised. I'm like, you're doing it with DNS?
Yeah, I mean, that's Mozilla's point, right? I mean, is that if that's how you're doing filtering, you are already having a bad time, and us adding this really isn't going to make anything materially worse. And I think I agree with that. I mean, the way they're trying to do it, you know, isn't going to do what they want, and they should probably accept that sooner rather than later. And I think DNS over HTTPS is just an inevitability. We're going to see
it
adopted by all the browsers, and then, you know, kind of onwards from there, and probably for the better.
I think so too, but like there are privacy concerns. I just don't want to see like a handful of really big providers who are doing that. And then, yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, because there is a bit of a privacy thing there. Your DNS over HTTPS provider, if it's like Google or someone, it's just another store of information for them that they can sort of tie to you.
Yeah, but that's probably also many of the same people who already have that information from other means anyway. I mean, Cloudflare or Facebook or Google, you know, already have that much visibility anyway. So, you know, I don't know whether DNS makes it materially worse, and we get some benefit from it.
Yeah, that's true. Catalin is also wrote a story this week talking about, a malware strain using DNS over HTTPS, like, which, I mean, I just thought, like, that's pretty cool considering it's quite new. But I think this is a bit of a red herring, because covert CNC, like, there's other ways. You don't need DNS over HTTPS. It's not like DNS over HTTPS is increasing the risk because it's enabling malware in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the angle the story was taking is that there are some mechanisms that people rely on to spot malware in the environments by looking for DNS queries for known indicators of compromise, and by doing it over TLS, then you lose that visibility, which is, I think, probably what the malware in question is trying to do. But it's just kind of funny. The thing I thought was funny is, you know, we've gone from, you know, command and control over port 23 to command and control over HTTP to command and control over DNS because HTTP gets proxied, and now we're back to command and control over DNS over HTTPS. It's kind of a funny evolution, and yeah, maybe that's an amusing way of doing it. But yeah, I mean, there's so many ways you can do covert C2, this is just one of them.
It is just one of them, and I'm not so worried about this idea that, like, I mean, you will be able to do DNS over HTTPS to your own DNS over HTTPS server if you want, or even better, pay a few bucks a month and you're going to get really good filtering, you know, if you choose a server. Like, it's just a different, it means running managed DNS is going to be so much easier, right, on the client side.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, the structure of the internet is changing, right? I mean, it used to be that your ISP provided your mail server and all of the other, you know, kind of first services that you would hit, DNS being one of them. Now DNS is one of the only things that your ISP still provides you because you use other services for your mail, and they're just losing that as well. And, you know, the internet's changing. We're going to have to deal.
Canonical, the company behind Ubuntu, had one of its GitHub accounts hacked. But don't worry, because that apparently happens all the time.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's not a great look. And I mean, I believe that the Git accounts in question are not ones that are used for kind of primary development. Obviously, they have a bunch of their own infrastructure for managing the source code and package build and stuff for the actual operating system. And the attacker
here, all they did was set up a couple of repos, basically.
Well, that's what they have. That's the visible part of it. Who knows what else they've done? But yeah, in the end, it's just a really bad look for Canonical, because I mean, there's so much stuff that runs on Ubuntu, and they, you know, they got to be better than that. I know a bunch of the people over there at Canonical, and I'm sure they are having to think about what they've done.
They're sitting in the corner thinking about what they've done. A Ruby library, and this is another one from Catalan. He's, you know, a machine as always, just pumping out the stories. But I like how he describes this as a backdoor found in a Ruby library for checking for strong passwords, right? But he calls it a popular Ruby library, and then you get into the story and it's like been downloaded like 547 times, which I don't know if that makes it super popular. But anyway, it's one of these libraries that lets you do like password checking for a user password to, you know, it'll tell you if it's like weak, medium, strong, very strong, that sort of thing. But yeah, it does a test to see when it's in a production environment as per, you know, as compared to a test environment. And when it's in prod, it starts like pulling in all sorts of nasty payloads and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty funny and a really great example of the sorts of supply chain stuff that we do have to worry about. But the you know, standout bit of this story is really the guy who found it.
Someone actually looked at the code that they were using. Like, who does that? I mean,
this guy gets Developer of the Year award in my book. He wrote up a blog post about this particular backdoor, and he found it because he has a process of going through all of the change logs of all of the software that his software depends upon, and then happened to come across something that didn't match, you know, where the version on the Ruby Gems distribution side didn't match the version in GitHub. And so he started looking at the differences, and sure enough, you know, found a backdoor. And you know, the number of developers that will actually go and do that before they update their Docker containers or update their, you know, their Kubernetes or whatever is pretty few, unfortunately, and this really, you know, is an example of doing it right, and you know, caught a live one.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is amazing that someone actually did it right, because everyone's busy, right? So it's good to know that some people out there will actually make the effort. The Tor project is fixing this bug, and I didn't even know about this bug until I read this piece. But there's a DOS condition basically, and it's a pretty simple one, right? You basically just connect a Tor, you know, connect to a Tor hidden service, right? And you just keep loading it up with connections and circuits, and you can load it up with thousands. It's like a resource exhaustion thing. But I guess what makes it tricky is if you're running a Tor hidden service, there's no way to determine the origin of the connection. So you can't just like drop an IP because you don't know where it's coming from, which means, you know, this bug's been around for years and no one quite knows how to fix it. And it's been responsible for like DOSing a whole bunch of shady like underground markets out of existence. Like, this is apparently the bug that killed Dream Market. The admins just gave up.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's not a terrible thing, but the funny part about this story is because it's such an important bug for those operators, we've seen
they've been lobbying. The drug dealers got together to lobby Tor to fix it
and put their money where their mouth is. They actually sponsored the fix for this particular bug. Like the Tor project has a thing where you can put a bounty on a particular bug, like put some money up to kind of make the developers focus on fixing it into, you know, for some sort of reward. And yeah, they put their money together and have been doing that. So yeah, it's kind of a funny world.
So I think the fix that they've eventually come up with, it's like an option in the Onion service configuration where you can enable it. And the downside is it takes a lot longer for clients to connect to you and to form a circuit. Is that right?
Yeah, I think they're trying to raise the computational cost on the client so that then it's a more equal kind of thing and it isn't just asymmetric against the server. Because, yeah, it is kind of a hard problem to solve, you know, within the constraints of the things that Tor is meant to do.
Sign in with Apple is a new feature courtesy of Cupertino. And the OpenID Foundation is having a good old sook because Apple's done it in a slightly different way to the way that they do things, which means for a lot of website developers, that's going to mean, you know, maintaining two different sort of authentication methods. Who's right, who's wrong here, Adam? Because this isn't really my wheelhouse.
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, I think the core complaint that having one interoperable standard for this kind of thing does benefit everybody because you don't have to maintain multiple code bases, that kind of thing. I think that is entirely valid, and I would prefer that Apple did it, you know, kind of per the spec of the standard and let everyone get on with their lives. The actual specific technical differences are, I mean, some of them do seem relevant, and I think I would actually read, I mean, I haven't seen the Apple one, so I'm not sure what they've done instead of the controls that the OpenID group have, you know, what things they've done instead of those. But some of them do seem kind of like they ought to be things that Apple would have done, but they may have an alternate implementation some other way. So yeah, I don't really know yet, but I do think a single ecosystem is a benefit there. But I don't know about the specific technical stuff yet.
There you go. Now we mentioned earlier, you know, people hosting stuff on Azure, trying to get Microsoft certificates, you know, hosting things on Microsoft services. There is a bunch of phishing emails going around pretending to be Microsoft OneNote audio notes. And they very helpfully add the scanned by McAfee text to these phishing attempts. So they look totally legit.
Well, I mean, it's only got to work, right? And that's what we say around the office here. Like, it's only dumb if it doesn't get your shell. So, you know, I guess if you want to pretend to be a, you know, Microsoft audio note, then more power to you.
Someone set up this fake firmware updating thing for Samsung phones and 10 million people have installed it. So what this is it says that, it's your firmware installer and you can use the free version, right? But then what you do is you try to download your firmware, which is free anyway, right? Like if you just do it through the OS. But you try to download this and it throttles it to like 56 kilobytes a second. Just throttles the crap out of it and then prompts you to upgrade to their paid service to get faster firmware updates. 10 million installs.
Oh, it really is pretty sad, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, it means 10 million people want to update the firmware on the Samsung phones.
Like, glass half full. Glass half full.
That's amazing. Good on you, everybody who downloaded this. But not so great that that they're getting scammed in the process. And, you know, you'd hope that Google would just have no tolerance for this and we'll pull it out of the App Store and Google Play Store and we'll all be done with it. But, you know, maybe not.
Yeah. Now, 17-year-old me is all over this next one. Slurpees and smokes on the house, Adam.
Oh, dear. So the 7-Eleven convenience store chain in Japan, they decided that they were going to put together a mobile app that supported, you know, payment with your mobile phone when you go to buy the aforementioned Slurpees and Smokes and presumably Bento and other good things in Japan that are better than Slurpees and Smokes. You rock up to the checkout and you've got a, you know, QR code or whatever on your phone. You scan the thing and it charges the credit card or the debit card that's associated with your, you know, 7-Eleven account. Easily, you know, nicely implemented mobile payment solution, no problem. Yeah, except the password reset process for this particular application. So when you go to reset the password, it has an input box where you put in, you know, like the email address of the account, you know, the login name, the date of birth, I think, the phone number you had to know. And then it has another input box, which is where would you like the password reset email link mailed to?
Yeah.
Which is to say, not the account holder's email.
Now, who'd have thought that would be abused?
Who would have thought, indeed?
Now, 7-Eleven, their customers lost about $500,000 due to this. And I'm just telling you, man, this is the sort of thing that would have spread like wildfire through high schools, right?
Well, apparently, Tokyo police have arrested two Chinese men in their 20s. So they must be late bloomers, I guess.
Really late bloomers. Jeez, come on, get it together. At the other end of the spectrum, when it comes to, you know, financial misdeeds on the internet, we got this group, Silence, the Silence Crew. They apparently made off with about $3 million from Bangladesh's Dutch Bangla Bank.
Yeah, this is the crew that's been infiltrating a bunch of bank networks around the place, Bangladesh, India, Sri Lanka, Kyrgyzstan, and then obviously getting into the systems that support the ATMs. And then, you know, we're seeing groups of mules show up at the ATM, make a phone call, and then a whole bunch of money comes out of the ATM. So that kind of process. This particular crew has been around for a little while, and yeah, clearly seem to be making, you know, some pretty real cash out of this process. And yeah, kind of, if you're operating a bank ATM network, maybe you should, you know, be aware of this.
Now, you know, it's great seeing Brian Krebs go back to his roots, because last week we spoke about him doing some quality Krebsing. More quality Krebsing this week.
This is very solid Krebsing. He's been looking into the operations of this ransomware group called GandCrab, who have apparently exited the market, having retired, having made, I think they said, what, like, that they pulled out something like $2 billion worth of extortion payments over the years.
Better than a kick in the proverbials, isn't it?
Yeah. They personally say they've made 150 mil. Krebs, of course, decided to go pull the thread on the OPSEC of the various people behind this. And, yeah, one of the guys in question, he got Krebs pretty hard here. Krebs has figured out where he lives and what he does for a living and, you know, kind of what sort of car he drives. And, it's one thing to be Krebs, right? I mean, have all your name and various email history and posting histories shoved up on the internet. But it's another thing when it's married up with, by the way, I'm boasting about having $150 million on a forum, and now we know which small town you live in Russia. Like, I imagine a lot of people are going to be pretty interested in where he's got to.
Yeah, but I'm guessing this guy can afford the bribes, right? So he should be fine.
Yeah, you'd hope so. But, you know, 150 mil, I would not. I don't think I want to keep that, you know, in the back of my pants while I'm walking around in Russia.
Now, we've got a post here from Trail of Bits. This is this week's sort of reading recommendation. It's called Seriously Stop Using RSA.
Yeah, this is, obviously people have had opinions about all sorts of crypto systems over the years. And the RSA system as a whole, you know, has been getting kind of creaky with age. And this write-up really does. It's based on a conference presentation. And you're going to have to use the bleeping function because the conference presentation was called F*** RSA. And the general gist of it amongst all of the other crypto bits is just don't. Like, there's no reason to use RSA for anything anymore. Use something else and save yourself a whole bunch of grief.
There you go. Link is in the show notes. Now, before we go, we've actually got to correct a flub, my flub from last week. We spoke about a company that filed for bankruptcy after a breach. I flubbed it and said it was LabCorp. It wasn't LabCorp. It was the collections agency that had done work for LabCorp. So apologies to the listeners for getting that wrong. We were catching up on an awful lot of news last week, so that one just sort of slipped through. And also, Adam, you and I were sort of joking about, ha, 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 wouldn't it be great, you know, if there was Microsoft Linux. Wouldn't that be weird, you know? Well, under WSL2, which I think there's a beta out there already, you actually can run Linux on Windows. People are doing it.
We are familiar with WSL, I guess, is the point Pat's trying to make there. And yeah, with WSL2, you can, in fact, run Microsoft package Linux kernel as opposed to their kind of translation layer that comes with WSL version 1. So yeah, it's definitely worth having to play with. If you do use a lot of Unix tools and you'd rather have a desktop, you know, where power management worked and that kind of thing, you know, secure boot, all those. Of course, now people are going to tell me that secure boot works in Linux. Yes, I know that you can do secure boot in Linux as well. But you know what I'm trying to say here. I'm trying to make a joke about Linux on the desktop. So yes.
Yes, Linux on the desktop. Tools. But, you know, as you pointed out, because we were talking about that through the week, because people are like, oh, there already is, you know, Microsoft Linux. But, you know, the point that you made was that, you know, it's not really there yet, is it? Even under WSL2, there's like a whole bunch of edge cases that kind of make it not appropriate.
Yeah.
Like you can't run Emacs, I think you were saying.
You can't run Emacs. And of course, that just makes it not acceptable at all. But no, there are a few things that are going to make it a bit rough around the edges still. But, you know, they're definitely getting there. And I think it's the right, you know, running the whole kernel does seem to be the right approach, you know, compared to some of the, you know, compatibility problems with their, you know, WSL1 style of doing it. So
yeah. Do they have Edge for Linux yet? Because, you know, if they did, then you'd be able to use all of Microsoft's like online services, and then who cares? You pretty much just, you know, you wouldn't need much more beyond Edge and, you know, their own kernel.
They did ship IE for Solaris, I'll have you know, once upon a time. So the listeners won't fault me on that.
Like,
you know.
That sounds like, just retrospectively, that sounds like probably the worst thing that's ever been published. IE for Solaris. Oh, dear. Shudder. But yes, Adam, that is it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us. That was a lot of fun, my friend, and I'll chat to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Zane Lackey, the co-founder of Signal Sciences. Zane and his pal Andrew founded Signal Sciences, and the whole idea was to create a company that made security software for DevOps environments, or for the products of DevOps environments, I guess. So these days they describe it as a next generation WAF, and yeah, I think that's actually a reasonable description. They've recently launched a cloud version of their product. So Zane and I talk about why they did that in just a moment, and then we talk about his experience at a couple of recent non-security conferences. More and more high-quality security content is creeping in to conferences that are for people who work in networking and developers and things like that, so we go over that. But first up, I started off by asking Zane why Signal Sciences actually released a cloud-based version of its product, given that there are already so many cloud-based WAFs out there on the internet already. And here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I think a few different reasons. So number one, for us, it was really, as practitioners, we needed a number of different ways to be able to deploy security technologies, right? I think one of the huge challenges that we had as in-house security folks was your security vendor would come in and give you one way to deploy, and you'd be fighting these horrific political battles to try to get some security technology deployed. And what we really needed in-house was as many different possible ways of deploying as they could give us. Usually the challenge there was that, you know, if the vendor gave you a bunch of different ways to deploy, they'd all have different configuration options. They'd all go into separate spots and none of them would have feature parity or anything like that. So what we just recently launched that we're biased, but we're quite excited about is another deployment option that our customers can use, and that's Cloud WAF. So for them, all you have to do is make a single DNS change. So there's no agents to deploy, none of that kind of overhead that folks are used to. You just make a DNS change, it flows through there. And the huge differentiator, exactly to your point, is that this all goes into the same backend. So it's the same management console. You get the full feature parity with everything else.
Right,
so
right.
What
okay.
We see with customers, they'll get, one business unit might deploy in one way, another business unit will deploy with Cloud WAF, and they're able to manage it all the same and get that same feature parity.
Well, I guess, the thing is you've been around long enough now to actually have users who are comfortable with your stuff, right? And and I see this in the risky business as well, right? Which is when, you've got a marketing manager who really likes dealing with risky biz, who's working for a cool company. You know, they get bored, they move over to another cool company and they're like, hey, we want to become a client, right? So it's the same thing, I'm guessing. You would see that sort of repeat business where people want to use your stuff, but they can't because of the politics of installing agents on the web servers.
That's exactly. I think our record now is a customer so we've been around about 5.5 years. We now have one customer who's gone through 4 jobs in that time and has brought us into every one of them. Cloud WAF is now the latest version of that because exactly like you said, they went into a new customer or they went into a new job and that one, the DevOps team said, we don't care how fast things are. We're never going to install any agents on our systems. And he said, actually, perfect timing because now we can just do Cloud WAF here and get that same functionality.
Now you're not doing any sort of volumetric DDoS protection though on this, are you?
No, so we focus on, and this has been this has been our focus since day one, is focus on the problems that you're really well suited to solve. And so for us, that is all about the web layer stuff. So we don't touch the layer 3, layer 4, like your classic SYN floods and those sort of things, because that's really been commoditized, to be totally honest. And so what we do is we focus on the web layer stuff. So the app layer DDoS, where we really see so many of the attacks actually shifting to, that's what customers use us for on the DDoS side. They'll use their, their layer 3, layer 4 network-based or appliance-based DDoS stuff. But then what they see is, hey, the attackers are actually moving up to doing DDoS that targets the application itself. And that's where we come in. And that's what we focus on for the DDoS piece of it.
Well, and people are deploying you behind the CDN too. So, they've got other ways of
fixing
that.
That's a super common deployment.
Yeah.
Super common deployment is to drop behind the CDN to start out with.
Now, look, I mean, I'm sure it would be fantastic news for you, but if this is staggeringly successful, will it embarrass you a little bit given that you you've been doing it on the box all this time and then you launch a cloud service and it sort of turns out that's what people want?
No, because it's really the evolution of what we've always seen on this. Right. We've never thought about this from the problem of, oh, we're going to make these few different deployment options and that's it. Our focus has always been on make as many possible deployment options as there are, because we've been in our customer shoes and know the political realities of getting things deployed. And sometimes with one team, it's easy to deploy a Cloud WAF style deployment. With other teams, we actually see teams purposely choosing that they actually want agents on their systems because they get such high performance out of them.
And yeah, so I mean, are there other advantages as well? Because I mean, your software as deployed on a web server, it does hook stuff that's not going to be available to, you know, to you as a, you know, some sort of reverse proxy, right? Like, you're not going to get like logs, because you do examine logs and stuff, don't you, on your server software?
So we look at the full web request and response. So we don't tend to touch the logs that are actually on disk, but we're looking at the full traffic there so that
you can get that when you're in line. So that's not a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So there's the shameless plug for Signal Sciences new stuff. This is available now, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, that's available now. We've got a bunch of customers in production today with that.
Excellent. Okay. Available and in production. Now, look, another thing we were going to talk about is you went to a couple of conferences. You went to an AWS conference. You also went to a Cisco conference. And you were actually encouraged by what you saw. It was less of the sort of token security sessions and more, you know, a serious part of the conference. Is that right?
Yeah. So it was, I think it was kind of the evolution of something that a lot of us have been expecting for a while, which is, for so many of us on the security side, you know, we all go to the same security conferences and it's all the big security echo chamber. And I think for a lot of us that are trying to kind of push things forward on the defensive side, there's been this push to say, hey, let's really go try to speak at developer conferences and DevOps conferences and get out of the security echo chamber. And so I think the last couple of years, you've started to see some more security related talks at those sort of conferences. But it's, you know, still typically been one or two. I think what was really interesting from both of those conferences, so the AWS Reinforce, which is their new security one, and then the Cisco Live event that we were at, is that it really started to show kind of the convergence of development, DevOps, and security. So the AWS Reinforce one, even though it was a security conference, there was, and I don't know for, you know, all the listeners that were there, if they had the same experience, but something that we saw was there were a bunch of folks who weren't really traditional security folks. They were coming from the development side and the DevOps side, and it ended up being about kind of a even split from, you know, our kind of anecdotal evidence of folks that were there from the technology side and from the security side. And I thought that was a really healthy mix of folks that we should be striving towards as an industry. And then the same thing at the Cisco Live one, which we were at because we were announcing a new integration that we just did with the Cisco Threat Response product. We saw there, you know, a lot of classic sort of network folks, network engineer folks, and they had a whole track dedicated around infrastructure as code and kind of teaching folks around, you know, containers and config management and all of this sort of stuff. And I think it's the early positive signs of a trend that I really hope continues, and something I know I've talked with a bunch of other security leaders about, which is we can't just have the security echo chamber conferences and then the one or two security talks at developer conferences. We really need to start trying to blend the two to get both sides learning from each other and helping each other move forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, right? Because I've seen that many talks on DevOps stuff now that I feel like even I kind of understand what's involved in running a DevOps program, and that's just going to security events. So I feel like the, you know, this is what developers do style of talks, and, you know, this is what we can do to support that. I feel like that's something that's very much been present at security events for a while. It's nice to know that the you know, a similar sort of thing is happening in the, you know, developer space and the networking space as well.
Yeah, and hopefully taking it to that next level, right? I think each of them had the sort of intro style courses like you mentioned. I think now it's, let's get these audiences together to show that, hey, there's security technology that can actually enable your shift to cloud, enable your shift to DevOps. And the same thing from reverse of saying, hey, we care about security during this shift. Bring us technologies that we can actually use as we're going to cloud, as we're embracing DevOps.
One of my favorite developer meets security issues that I just think, you know, in the DevOps space that I just think is hilarious. Nothing to do with what you guys do, right? But it's the whole PAM module problem, right?
Yeah.
Where you've got a security group that wants DevOps teams to use these hideous broken PAM modules for workloads that are spinning up for like 10 seconds, right? And it doesn't work, right? It just doesn't work. And that's, for me, that's just like a perfect example of where the friction is.
Yep. Oh, completely, right? I think security has been able to, you know, going back to the data center and the waterfall world, security was able to force things on the other teams. And this has been the biggest change to the security industry, I think, ever, is the shift to DevOps and cloud or digital transformation, whatever you want to call it, means that those teams are actually, if they don't like what security is bringing to the table, they're generally able to move around the security team. And so security needs to be focused on bringing technologies to the plate that actually support the shifts that those teams are going through and actually gives them some security value themselves.
Jesse Irwin did a really great talk at OSCERT, was that like a couple of months back? And I think there was one thing that she said that really stuck with me, which was that, you know, we can transform security departments essentially into services organizations. Like that was like her way of sort of framing it. Like, think of yourself as a service organization that offers services to these teams to help them get stuff done. And I just think that that way of expressing it, I mean, it did really stick with me because I think that that type of thinking is going to be quite useful.
Completely agree. I mean, it was something that I talked a bit about internally with my team going back to the Etsy days and running security there, where I'd say even take it one step further. And if you're running a security organization, think of it as you're running a business inside the business that you're at, because you need to be thinking about how are you marketing your security team internally so that the rest of the business wants to come talk to you. How are you delivering products that they actually want, right? And bringing in technology partners that support them. And if you think of it as a services organization and essentially taking it even one step further and think of it as a business and how are you doing marketing? How are you delivering products? How are you making sure that your customers are successful? I think you can build a really successful security organization.
Yeah. I mean, look, that's that very much is in line with what Jesse was talking about. But Zane, that's all we're going to have time for this time, mate. Thank you very much for joining us. I understand you are just back from your honeymoon. Wonderful travels in Italy. Everybody's very jealous. Welcome back. Welcome back. And I'm very sorry that you are forced back into work. I'm sure your heart is still in Italy. But thank you very much, mate. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely, man. This was a great way to come back. So great to chat.
That was Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences there. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to Signal Sciences for sponsoring this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. And big congrats also to Zane for getting married. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I posted a soapbox episode with Silence earlier this week, talking about their persona stuff. And I got another one dropping soon, which is a really, really great chat with Ryan Callumber at Proofpoint. And that one's really interesting. So do keep an eye out for it. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.